It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is off today. Coming up on Central Time, there's a new effort being launched to ensure that healthy food and beverage options are available in all Wisconsin hospitals and health clinics. First, for over two decades, Wisconsin's Family and Medical Leave Act and the federal version have coexisted in our state. But there's a motion as part of the proposed state budget that would make the federal act the prevailing law in Wisconsin, scrap a lot of the state version. Chris Reeder joins us now. He's the Director of Health and Human Resources Policy for Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, which is supporting this change. Chris, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, good afternoon, Rob. Thank you for giving us this opportunity.
So, as we mentioned, the Wisconsin law here, Family and Medical Leave Act, passed 1988, federal version, a few years after that. Why the need, the impetus to make a change now?
Sure, and you know, I think understanding the history of it is important, and the history kind of guides us to where we are. You're right. Governor Tommy Thompson signed the state law in 1988. It was kind of a groundbreaking law at the time in the country. He was a new governor at the time. It was one of his first initiatives, as I'm told, at least. President Clinton, in 1993, one of his first initiatives was to sign a federal law. The issue kind of had taken hold in the country and was passing in a couple different states, and he brought it to the federal level. The issue, you know, while we've lived under this situation with these two different laws for the 20 years since, the issue is simply that the definitions used in the state law and then the definitions that were used by President Clinton at the federal level simply don't sync up. And so there's always been inconsistency when it comes to, you know, defining what employers are eligible, what employees are eligible, what, you know, the different types of leave are. There's just been out of sync. And for HR professionals, and that's where the issue really drives from, is for people who, you know, day in and day out are handling the paperwork that goes on behind the scenes of family leave cases when somebody takes off for maternity leave or for a serious health condition or, you know, what have you. It's the HR professionals who, you know, have to figure out how do we figure, you know, fill out the different forms to comply with both state and federal, and what are the consequences if we make a mistake? What are the litigation potentials? What are the, you know, the consequences with the State Department of Workforce Development or at the Department of Labor? Not by malintent, but simply by making a mistake because we have these two different sets of laws. So the effort, which really isn't new, there was a bill 4 years ago that didn't make it through. That bill would have completely rewritten Wisconsin's family medical leave law to match word for word what the federal law was. That bill didn't make it through. What the bill that we're hoping what the legislature will propose now will do is it says if you're a state employer, and it doesn't matter if you're a school district, a county, or you're a heavy manufacturer, if you're an employer and you're required under federal law to follow federal family medical leave, that you're exempt from following the state law, except in a couple areas that we recognize where there's a difference that we should continue to recognize that difference, such as providing leave to care for a domestic partner, providing leave to care for a parent-in-law, or you know, if you have a domestic partner, your domestic partner in-law, so some items like that we're maintaining in this proposal, but for the most part, it absolutely says if you're a company or an employer, because it's public employers too, and you have to follow federal law, you know, follow federal law, but we want to relieve you of a lot of the paperwork that goes on behind the scenes.
So you're with Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce supporting this. The League of Wisconsin Municipalities also representing a number of employers. Local government supports this. Employees hearing that might be skeptical, thinking the net result is going to be fewer benefits, less access to family and medical leave when all is said and done. Is that the end result of making these changes?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, I would actually say that you know, if you look at what leave is required under federal law and state law, you know, for instance, if you think of kind of the standard bearer of what we think of as maternity leave, and you think of 12 weeks off, you know, that's kind of what is the general thought of what maternity leave is. That's actually a federal provision. State law actually only provides 6 weeks off. So the law that we're looking to enshrine, the law that, you know, President Clinton signed that provides the 12 weeks, will still be the law of the land when it comes to maternity leave. There's a number of areas where federal law is more generous than our current state law is. Length of leave, as I just mentioned, the 12 weeks. Federal law actually has a provision for taking time off to care for certain military circumstances, and state law doesn't address that. Federal law is better for employees when it comes to getting second and third opinions. Under federal law, the employer has to pay for those second and third opinions. Under state law, the cost is split with employers and employees. Enforcement is better for employees under federal law. Remedies are better under federal law. So absolutely not. This is not an effort to reduce benefits. It's an effort to say, there's a lot of really behind-the-scenes paperwork that goes on to comply with both sets of laws. And at the end of the day, if this is successful, employees in Wisconsin won't notice a difference. It's the HR professionals who will, in having their job made a little bit easier. And the consequence of that is that employers, and again, public and private, will be able to better utilize money that right now is going into having stronger HR departments than they probably need. In 39 other states, federal law is the law of the land. Wisconsin is one of 11 that has a standalone bill. And so if this passes, it will bring us somewhat in sync. Again, we're not completely federalizing. We recognize some of the differences that are good. So it will bring us in sync to a certain degree with federal law and alleviate those behind-the-scenes paperwork issues that HR professionals deal with. But for workers, we don't anticipate that it's something that will really affect workers.
Talking to Chris Reeder with Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce about possible changes to the state's Family and Medical Leave Act. Now, as I understand it, one thing that might change is the ability of an employee in Wisconsin to split up the use of their time. So, say, a mom and a dad tag teaming, taking their time off, 3 weeks on, 3 weeks off, that sort of thing. Would that change? Would that the ability to do that be reduced in these changes?
I'd say there's probably a potential for paperwork differences, but I would highly doubt that there would be a real difference in what is actually enforced and applied afterwards. So this is an area where under state law, taking intermittent leave is what you're talking about. Taking intermittent leave is simply it's allowed under state law for those 6 weeks of leave without really any questions asked. Under federal law, again, I'm assuming you're talking about for kind of the birth of a child, taking care of that child. Under federal law, intermittent leave for that circumstance is allowed if there's a serious medical condition, just like any other leave for taking time off. Intermittent leave for taking time off simply for what you just said, kind of splitting it up 3 weeks and then the other parent takes 3 weeks. That's still allowed. It's not prohibited, but it would require a little more dialogue with the employer just to make sure that it's not, something where on Friday you tell your employer, hey, I'm not showing up next week. And so under federal law, it's absolutely allowed. It's not prohibited, but it requires a dialogue with the employer to kind of work it out.
At the federal or state levels, the things required here, the amount of leave, the amount of unpaid leave, that's a minimum. Does that restrict employers' ability to go beyond that in terms of these benefits?
Oh, absolutely not. Everything that's in family leave is a floor. Employers absolutely can provide more, and frankly do provide more, and it's something that is. As we sit here in Wisconsin with a fairly low unemployment rate, employers, when they're looking to attract the best workers, are looking at things like their benefits package, their compensation, their leave policies, and figuring out what they need to offer in terms of making sure they attract the best clients. I like to frankly point to WMC. We're a small company. We have about 35 employees. We don't fall under the definition of needing to provide family leave under either state or federal law, but it's still part of our employment policies here. When my wife and I had a child last year, I was able to take some time off. And, WMC wasn't required by law to do that, but they, as a good corporate citizen, did so. And I think most Wisconsin employers fall under that basket.
Chris, thanks for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
That's Chris Reeder, Director of Health and Human Resources Policy for Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. Coming up, we'll hear about an effort to improve the food and beverage choices in Wisconsin's hospitals and clinics, trying to make them healthier and be a model for everyone else along the way. We all know that what we eat and drink has a big impact on our health. Well, this week, for the first time, nearly 100 representatives of Wisconsin hospitals and clinics are coming together to talk about how to ensure that the food served in healthcare facilities supports, encourages healthy living. Nan Peterson is a registered nurse and is director of child health advocacy for UW Health American Family Children's Hospital in Madison. Nan, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks.
So there's this Healthy Hospitals and Clinics Forum being held tomorrow here in Wisconsin. Why now?
Well, we're at the point where in Wisconsin we really want to try and move the dial within the four walls or how many walls of Wisconsin hospitals and clinics. You know, as healthcare providers, we obviously see the consequences of very preventable diseases and really feel that we have an obligation to lead the way in modeling healthy food and beverage choices for patients, their families, visitors that come, staff, and the community as a whole.
And I've seen at hospitals and elsewhere and heard about other ones doing this. The first step often seems to be getting sugary beverages out of vending machines and cafeterias in hospitals. Is that an example of the sort of thing you're working toward here?
That is an example, and that's a great one. We also, there are many other things that hospitals can do to get started on this path, and that's what we're hoping to engage leaders tomorrow on. I mean, it can be as simple as really trying to improve the education of what healthy means in a cafeteria or in a vending machine. It can relate to where you place products. So similar to the checkout at a grocery store, you know, when you're checking out at the hospital cafeteria, do you have healthy choices at that point, fruit and such, or is it maybe less healthy things? So there's quite a continuum of options that folks have to strategize to really improve that environment.
So it isn't necessarily just that, hey, this is a healthy bit of food I'm eating while I'm a patient or a visitor or staff member at a hospital. It's treating each of these interactions as kind of a teachable moment to take out of the clinic.
That's a great way to put it. It is. And so tomorrow we're really hoping to do a couple of things. One is to, we know that there's some great work happening in hospitals across the state, and so kind of capturing that. But we also know that there's probably some gaps and maybe folks that aren't as far along on that healthy hospital clinics continuum. And so what can we do to not have them reinvent the wheel, but share and connect and convene to move the dial here in Wisconsin?
And before we get into some of these specific examples, you know, hospital food used to be up there with airline food back when airlines had food as punchlines. Is there an effort to make sure that this is food we're going to want to eat in addition to it being healthy food?
You know, I've been in working with chefs and local farmers and purveyors. You can still have really healthy, good comfort food in a hospital environment. You just need to think about it a little bit differently, but it is very possible, and it's the work we should be aiming for.
Now, when I've been at hospitals as a patient or as a visitor, and I imagine the same is true for hospital staff, this is a very stressful place, and I would think that this would be a time where people are vulnerable to eating the worst possible food. Do you think that we might have been reinforcing exactly the wrong behavior in these situations in the past?
That could very well be. When you think about if you have an illness or an injury and what you want to do is heal as quickly as possible, and one of the ways that helps healing, of course, is, you know, getting your vitamins through your food and the appropriate healthy items. So it's just another way for us to help our patients as well.
Talking to Nan Peterson about a forum being held in Wisconsin tomorrow, bringing together hospitals and clinics and others around the state for a healthy hospital clinics and clinics forum, trying to make the food available at health facilities healthy, a model for better health behavior. So, Nan, let's get into, you mentioned a lot of different clinics and hospitals have tried different experiments. Some of them seem to be working. Tell us about some of the ones we might see if we're a visitor and we're going through the cafeteria at a hospital.
Sure. So I think we have a small group that have removed sugar-sweetened beverages, which is what you first identified. And that, you know, sugar is obviously not a good thing. And one of the things I think with sugar-sweetened beverages is folks are really worried about the fiscal impact of that, as hospitals do have a business side to them. But our experience, as well as national data on this, indicates that you just need to overcome that perceived revenue loss. And national data indicates that sales do resume to normal levels after an initial dip. One of the things that hospitals are doing are actually using somewhat of a pricing strategy to promote healthy choices, so that healthy choices might be priced lower than less healthy choices, to really try and promote that. The other piece that hospitals are doing are really trying to promote water. Staying hydrated with good, fresh, cool, sometimes maybe infused with fresh fruit or some herbs, it's just really good for you and it tastes good. And so I think it's a process of trying to change the culture a bit on what we really do enjoy.
Is there ever staff pushback on these things? Like, hey, I'm working 12-hour shifts here. Don't, you know, keep your hands off my soda.
Oh, sure. Yes. And I think, you know, we need to face that if there's a bit of resistance right up front and be very transparent and really try and promote the positive messages and educate through the content that we provide. And then it is, again, our obligation to make the healthy choice the easy choice for folks that are at our hospital.
Now, one thing that caught my eye, one of the sessions you've got at this conference is the title is From the Ground Up, Hospital Gardens and Food as Medicine. So hospitals growing their own food on their grounds, is that what we're going to see?
That's what we're trying to assess tomorrow, who's doing that. We know that some hospitals are gardening across the country. We don't have as good of a handle here in Wisconsin. Obviously, we have a shorter growing season, so being able to rely on that year-round is not an option for us, but even if starting with herbs and our seasonal vegetables would be a wonderful thing. So we're really hoping to learn more about that tomorrow.
And we hear a lot about buy local movements of one sort or another, mm-hmm. trying to get local food into places like schools, farmers markets. Are there any efforts like that at hospitals that you've heard of?
There are. There are folks coming together to be able to, because part of the problem is when you're a larger institution, being able to have the product that you need. And so some pooling of resources amongst farmers and purveyors and vendors to be able to get the amount of product that you need is happening out there. And again, hoping to learn a bit more about that tomorrow.
I don't want to ignore maybe the most important people we should be talking about at a hospital or clinic, the patients. So somebody there in a setting who's there for a heart condition, say, or diabetes or something like that, are the food options available maybe an educational lesson that can be part of their treatment?
Absolutely. You know, I have learned so much about this from the clinical dietitian world. They are clearly the experts and are able to work with patients and, most importantly, patients within families so that everybody's on the same page with not just the person that's had the heart attack or whatever, but to be able to embrace change within the family setting.
Now, you mentioned the fiscal element of one of these changes. That makes me think, you know, sometimes improving a hospital might be a new wing or really expensive new high-tech equipment. This sounds like potentially a cheap way to improve patient outcomes.
You know, you don't need a lot for this. The education is not expensive. You know, I think hospitals that have taken out their deep fryers and installed these high heat ovens, there is some cost there, but you're saving cost, we've been told, with not having to use the vats of oil anymore over the course of a year. So it's just the right thing to do.
And following up on the economic side of it, Are people ready, people who run clinics and hospitals, ready to make the upfront investment you mentioned that might pay off down the road?
I think we're starting to see that. You know, when you think about hospitals in Wisconsin, many of them even have the word health in them. And so we really need to be walking the talk, that we're having those conversations with the families and patients to model the way within our doors. And I think profitability is a perceived hurdle that to change, but most hospitals are finding that their numbers are holding steady, and again, hoping to reinforce that tomorrow.
All right, Nan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks.
We've been talking to Nan Peterson. She is Director of Child Health Advocacy for the UW Health American Family Children's Hospital in Madison, and she's one of the organizers of this conference we've been talking about called the Healthy Hospitals and Clinics Forum. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is off today. The gun debate is one of the most heated issues in American politics. Arguments between gun control advocates and gun rights supporters and battles over the intent of the Second Amendment have played out in the legal system as well as politics at local, state, and national levels. But our next guest says a lot of that debate has been pretty unproductive, and it misses out on the realities of why many Americans are choosing to own guns, not just own them, but carry them, and how these decisions relate to wider issues and part of what it means to be a citizen. Joining us now is Jennifer Carlson, sociologist at the University of Toronto. Her new book is Citizen Protectors, The Everyday Politics of Guns in an Age of Decline. Jennifer, thanks for joining us today.
Rob, thank you so much for having me.
So you jumped right into the world of guns. You attended gun-related events, trained to shoot, ended up becoming a trainer, an NRA-certified trainer. Why did you feel it was important to get that up-close personal perspective on the issue?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, I'm obviously, as you just said, a sociologist. And I actually assumed when I was, you know, this was actually my dissertation research. And I assumed when I was picking my topic and I was thinking about, you know, studying guns, that I would just find this wealth of, scholarship that involves, you know, talking to pro-gun Americans, interviewing them, hanging out with them. And what I found was that sociologists haven't really done that. So that was part of the reason that I wanted to kind of actually get up close and personal and talk to the Americans that, you know, find guns so important to their everyday lives that they actually carry them. So part of it was just, you know, the intellectual aspect of it. But then the other part of it really had to do with, the idea that this is not, you know, when you're talking about gun carry, this is not just, you know, this isn't granddaddy's shotgun that you got handed down that maybe is stashed under the bed in the event of a home invasion or something like that. This is this is something you do. This is something you practice. And so I wanted to, you know, not just talk to gun carriers, but also interview them, hang out with them, go through the training to carry a gun, go through the training to be an NRA instructor, to really understand what this kind of the practical aspect of it really is all about.
Now, we'll get into some of the individual stories you heard from the people you talked to, but big picture, you saw a theme emerge, a lot of gun owners viewing themselves as, like in the title of your book, citizen protectors. So what do you mean by that phrase, citizen protectors?
Yeah. Hello?
Go ahead. Yep.
Yeah. That term, this is a term that I'm using in the book. If you talk to someone who, you know, pro-gun advocates, they might use a term like the sheepdog. And so basically what this term refers to is this sort of moral obligation, this moral willingness to use force in order to protect innocent life. According to the citizen protector kind of model of citizenship, it's not just enough to not be a bad guy, right, to be a good guy. If you're a citizen protector, you take it one step further and say you're willing to protect the good guys or the good, you know, the innocent from the bad guys. And so what I argue in the book is that, you know, by looking at it from this lens of kind of duty and obligation, it actually helps to make sense of a lot that sort of operates under the surface in terms of our gun debate. So oftentimes the debate revolves around this question of, you know, individual rights and the right to self-defense. And what I found, and, you know, you can even read the text of, you know, stand your ground laws, where in the law it actually says, you know, this is not just about self-defense. This also sanctions intervening in crimes, in ongoing crimes, and that there actually is a big discourse of duty to others. And usually that comes out in terms of family, duty to family. Without that kind of extra aspect, it's really hard to sort of understand where pro-gun America is coming from. So that's why I use this term, because it really encapsulates both this sort of right to self-defense, but also this sense of moral politics that's going on.
So in talking to these gun owners, and you did most of this work in Michigan and Detroit and surrounding areas, Flint, Lansing, places like that, and a lot of the people you talk to explain their thinking about this role of protecting people in terms of societal and economic decline. So what were they looking at, and how did guns fit into that?
Yeah, I mean, socioeconomic decline actually is a big theme of the book, and partly this is exactly for the reason that you said. This is, you know, this book is primarily, it's all based in Michigan, looking primarily at Metro Detroit, and looking at how gun carriers see themselves vis-a-vis sort of different kinds of decline. So there's obviously the economic decline, and that has a whole set of sort of socioeconomic insecurities with it, but that translates into also crime, and so a sense that, you know, crime is, maybe it's not going up, but it's definitely, you know, it's definitely there as a possible risk. And then the last thing that also is kind of at play is this sense of social services sort of kind of being defunded. So actually, while I was doing the research, Flint laid off half of their police force. Even a place like Ann Arbor was losing police. So there was kind of this sense of, you know, even police are being defunded. And so the community, you know, people have to sort of take on this sort of protection role on themselves.
We're talking about the personal politics of carrying guns, and we'd like to hear from you. Not looking for arguments for and against gun control now. Want to hear your story. If you own firearms, if you carry them, if you view yourself as someone who's protecting others, why? What led you to do that? And if you've made a conscious decision not to own firearms, or to own them but maybe only use them for, say, hunting, let us know what was behind your thinking there. You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue our conversation with sociologist Jennifer Carlson. She's the author of the book Citizen Protectors, The Everyday Politics of Guns in an Age of Decline. We're talking about the personal decisions and attitudes toward gun ownership in the United States, and you can join the conversation. Tell us the story of why you do or don't own firearms, and why you do or don't carry them, concealed or openly. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Sociologist Jennifer Carlson stays with us. Her new book is Citizen Protectors, The Everyday Politics of Guns in an Age of Decline. She embedded herself basically with a pro-gun community, people who own guns, who carried guns, to find out what they were thinking, what led them to make the decisions they did. And Jennifer, you talked to a lot of different people, some African-American working class gun owners, white working class, white middle class. Did they have different perspectives and stories as to why they carried firearms?
Certainly, yeah. They definitely had different perspectives. So, I mean, that was one of actually the interesting parts of doing this research, is that there was definitely, so what I just described earlier on the first half of the segment about kind of the moral politics and the responsibility and that sort of thing, I found that pretty much across the board with the people that I talked to. But the question of race came out in really interesting ways. So one of the things that's really unique about the Metro Detroit, gun culture in Metro Detroit, gun carry culture in Metro Detroit, is that African Americans are actually licensed at higher rates than white residents, which is kind of surprising for a variety of reasons. For example, we think of white Americans as sort of, you know, the prototypical gun owner and gun carrier. And because one of the, you know, one of the reasons you can be disbarred from even getting a license is if you have a felony record. And we know that African American men tend to be more likely to have felony records. But nevertheless, African Americans in Detroit have more licenses per capita than white residents. And what I found that this really played out in terms of how they understood their role vis-a-vis police, vis-a-vis public law enforcement, and how they saw themselves as a role model for the community, particularly in Detroit. So one of the people that I actually opened the book with is this African-American man in his late 30s that I call Jason. Jason's an open carrier. He carries his gun openly in a holster, and he basically takes long walks around Detroit. And one of the stories that he told me was about how he was actually stopped by police who he described looked at him like he was Frankenstein. And the interesting part of the story was that he, you know, this is happening, and the police take his gun. He goes in, you know, into the back of the police car. The police are running his numbers. Everything's registered. Everything's legal. So, and this is happening on Woodward, which is a pretty busy street. Mm-hmm. And there happens to be a bus stop on the, you know, on the corner. People are gathering, not really because of Jason, but because there's a bus stop there. And, you know, Jason kind of narrates it and says, you know, I knew they were all thinking, here's another black man going to jail for a gun. And so he's recording all this and actually hands me the recording. I listen to it. He describes it and basically says, you know, at the end of the, you know, the police give me back my gun. They drive off and everybody just starts cheering. It starts to cheer because they can't believe the police gave me back my gun. And so he uses this story to sort of launch into this, you know, this discussion of how he, you know, sees himself sort of as a model for other men in his community. That, you know, stay out of trouble and you can be just like me. You can carry a gun openly. So that is the kind of story that I think really speaks powerfully to how guns and this kind of idea of citizenship and exercising rights really matters in kind of very unexpected ways in the contemporary context of gun carry culture.
Let's bring our callers in now with their stories. We've got Jenna on the line in Monticello. Jenna, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What's your story?
Well, I have been owning guns and using guns since I was around 10 years old. I still own a couple guns with my boyfriend, and we always keep them in a locked cabinet at our house and carry them usually in a case whenever we have to bring them out hunting. And that's pretty much all we use them for. But ever since the concealed and carry law, I've been pretty interested and have been debating about getting it because as also a bartender as a second job, it's scary having to close up as a girl all by yourself, and nowadays you can't trust people like you used to be able to. So I don't know. I don't think there's anything wrong with guns as long as you know how to use them.
Jenna, thanks a lot for that call. A lot there that we could dig into. Jennifer, first of all, she said mostly she uses guns for hunting, doesn't carry them around. That's a big part still of the gun owning community, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, historically, the U.S. has been, you know, there's been a, you know, a lot of, the gun culture has been really rooted in sort of rural America. And that's what's kind of interesting about gun carry culture is that, you know, as people are moving out of rural areas, this is kind of the new urban and suburban, American gun culture. But obviously hunting is still an important part of gun culture. And actually, there's a lot of evidence suggesting that women are, getting involved in hunting in record numbers, that women are one of the fastest growing groups of concealed carriers. So that's also something interesting. So my book actually focuses mostly on men, but I will say that this narrative of, you know, women thinking about, okay, I'm a real estate agent and I'm going into an abandoned house, or I'm working late at a bar and I'm closing out. That was the kind of narrative that I heard a lot from.
And something that Jenna said that really resonated with your book. Oh, it looks like we've lost Jennifer Carlson. We'll bring her back on the line. We're talking to sociologist Jennifer Carlson. Her new book is Citizen Protectors, The Everyday Politics of Guns in an Age of Decline. She wanted to get past the pro-con debate in guns and embed herself, meet with people who own guns, interview them, become an NRA-certified gun trainer to find out what motivates people to own guns, to carry them, conceal concealed or openly. Taking your calls at 800-642-1234. I want to hear your stories about why you do or don't own a gun, why you do or don't carry them openly. 800-642-1234 is the number, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Jennifer, we heard from Jenna. She said the line that struck me, and it fits a lot with your book, you can't trust people anymore. And a lot of the people you talk to have the perception of things aren't what they used to be. There was a better time. We're not in that anymore. That's why we need guns to defend ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because on the one hand, you know, crime has dropped. And, you know, actually a lot of, you know, a lot of the gun carriers that I talk to would say, hey, you know, I know crime is down. This is actually an argument for why we should have guns, because the fact that concealed carry has taken off while crime has dropped shows that it doesn't at least increase crime. But there's also this other narrative that isn't so much about crime, but about community really changing, community ties changing, that people have a different relationship to their community. And so I think this sense of, you know, that neighbors are different, I think that sort of erosion is actually kind of even more powerful maybe than you know, the sense of crime rates per se.
Back to our callers now. We've got Chris on the line in Madison. Chris, hi.
Yes, I just wanted to say that the author hits the nail right on the head. I am a healthcare provider and also a reservist, and I just got back from being a sheepdog for the entire country for a year. And I would go to one step further to say that anyone who doesn't possess the equipment and knowledge to protect themselves and their families against criminals is morally irresponsible.
Chris, thanks for the call, and that he's not alone in that, Jennifer. I think you talked to people about that who felt it wasn't just their responsibility. They saw this as a duty of a moral citizen to carry firearms, protect not just themselves but others.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think, you know, that the caller nails it on the head in terms of this kind of a language about talking about moral responsibility and that sort of thing. And so that obviously also raises the question of training and how much training should be required, which is actually a debate within, you know, among gun advocates and gun carriers. Should there be training requirements? If so, what should that look like? And that's also, you know, there, with the rise of sort of permitless carry and this notion that if you can own it, you should be able to carry it. That, I think, is actually kind of the new frontier of the gun debate.
Thanks a lot for the call. Jim in Rice Lake is with us next. Jim, hi.
Yes. I don't carry guns. I don't advocate it. I believe this country is full of morally bankrupted people, such as your previous caller, because we in Western society have one of the highest rates of untreated mental illness in the world. And we have the easiest and greatest open access to firearms in the world, which leads to slaughters of moviegoers in Colorado and children in schools in Connecticut. And then we have people simply sacrificing public safety for their xenophobic pleasure of owning a gun.
Jim, thanks for the call. So that's another perspective. You talked more to the gun owners, but this is a concern. Too many guns, mm-hmm. And we don't necessarily trust everybody to be out there being a moral citizen protector, having mm-hmm. access to these guns.
Yeah, and I think that's a great perspective as well, to think about, you know, what my book really looks at is this sort of the moral politics of gun carriers and gun culture and trying to understand gun carry culture. But there's this whole other question, which is how do the laws we pass, how do gun control policies actually work on the ground? How is it that someone's background gets checked? What are the different processes that an application goes through? So that's actually my next book, is actually looking at this question. So I'm interviewing police officers. I'm talking to the people who actually process the concealed pistol license applications to actually find out, you know, how is it that people do or do not slip through the cracks. So yes, next, in about 5 years, I'll be able to answer and address that a little bit more. But I think that's kind of the key question, because we talk about, you know, gun laws and gun policies at this very kind of meta level. But in terms of how this actually works on the ground, it's a pretty complicated question.
Back to our callers. Kurt is with us in Galesville. Kurt, hi.
Hi there. I was just telling the screener that I'm a self-described liberal, but I also feel it's important for people that feel that comfortable owning firearms to keep them. And there's two reasons. One is I think it's our moral responsibility to maintain status quo based on our rich history of militia in this country. And believe me, I don't go to any militia meetings. I'm not a anti-government person, but I feel that just the fact that I own a gun helps maintain the status quo. The other point I wanted to make is I actually grew up in Barack Obama's old neighborhood in Chicago, which is a very liberal neighborhood. And in that neighborhood, I did not feel a need to own a gun. However, I did move into a more rural area, and we had a prowler come by, and it took 45 minutes for a police officer to come and investigate. So it's very helpful to have a firearm if you're in a rural situation. So it's something that most city dwellers don't really understand.
Kurt, thanks for the call. And actually, Jennifer, a lot of the city dwellers you talk to relate similar situations, or that they don't trust that police arrive quickly enough.
Yeah, exactly. When I was doing this research, now this response time has dropped dramatically, but when I was doing the research, the response time for Detroit police to get to a call was on average about 58 minutes. Now they've actually lowered it quite a bit. But I think that that's something to kind of really think about, not just in terms of rural areas, but also urban areas. And the other thing I wanted to say also is, you know, we hear a lot about this kind of great American crime drop, that crime has dropped across the U.S. But when you actually look at the numbers, crime is still very concentrated, and some places have really benefited from that crime drop, other places not as much. So in Detroit, for example, Detroit in 2012 had one of their highest murder rates since the early 90s. So this is something that kind of needs to be part of the public discourse, that, you know, that it's not just these, we have to get away from kind of the macro level, crime is up or crime is down, rural, you know, there's, you know, these kind of presumptions about police presence in rural versus urban America. And
Jennifer, we'll have to leave it there. That was Jennifer Carlson. Her new book is Citizen Protectors.